We, the representatives of the United States of America, do solemnly publish and declare that these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. And for the support of this declaration, with a firm reliance on the protection of divine providence, we mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor.
Welcome to Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness, a podcast commemorating the 250-year anniversary of the Declaration of Independence. The show is sponsored by the Amerikazentrum in Hamburg, Germany, and I'm your host, Andrew Sola. The series has focused a lot on the famous, lofty ideals expressed in the Declaration. All men are created equal. All men are endowed with unalienable rights, such as life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. All tyrants are bad. All patriots are good. Freedom is awesome. Give me liberty or give me death. Well, what if none of those ideals really mattered to the founders? What if the American Revolution was really all about money? This hypothesis would confirm a long-standing negative stereotype about Americans, that all we care about is money and that all we ever really cared about is money. From the first plantation owners in the South to the first merchants in the North, from the earliest settlers at Plymouth Rock to every immigrant who followed thereafter, all Americans and all wannabe Americans have only ever been interested in one thing and one thing only, the almighty dollar. So our theme today is money and the Declaration of Independence. Why was money so important to the early colonists in North America? Why did they get so mad at King George when he started taxing them and restricting their trade, taking their money? What kind of money, though, did they use? What role did money play in financing the War of Independence? What were bills of credit? How did the 13 colonies create their own monetary policy? What was the continental dollar? And anyway, what the heck is money? Fortunately, I have an expert guest with me today to explain everything you ever wanted to know about the importance of money in the American Revolution, Dr. Andrew Edwards. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you, Andrew. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Dr. Edwards is a historian of early America and capitalism at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland. We have a trifecta of Andrew today. He is the author of Money and the Making of the American Revolution, which has just been released by Princeton University Press. Hooray. A link is in the show notes. So, Andrew, I have often overlooked that phrase in the Declaration. We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, our money, and our sacred honor. Okay, I get the fact that they needed to pledge their lives because they were committing high treason against King George and they would be executed if they were captured. And I guess I get the idea of sacred honor because somehow I believe there was some notion of honor back then. But I never really paid attention to that little comment about our fortunes, risking our fortunes. These very wealthy men are essentially saying we are all in with our lives, and we're all in financially. If we lose this War of Independence, we'll be dead and also bankrupt. So, Andrew, how do you start telling the story of the importance of money in the colonies?
Well, the amazing thing about the Declaration of Independence, from the perspective, I guess, of monetary history, from my perspective, is that they thought it was possible to declare independence to begin with. Right. So when we think back, we kind of like imagine the way that money works in the 18th century. We tend to think of gold and silver, right? Like silver coins, dollars, pieces of eight, right? The English pound sterling. But what was kind of fascinating about early America and sort of defined early America is that, in fact, they didn't have gold and silver. They did not, in fact, have any money to go to war with on British terms. And yet they believed it was possible. They believed it was possible to financially support a war without sort of the generally accepted means of exchange that something like the British government would have thought was necessary. And the reason they thought that was possible is because they had invented a completely new kind of money, one that did not, in fact, rely on gold and silver coins. So even though they didn't have the money to go to war, because they'd rethought money, because they were working through money on their own terms, they believed it was possible to fight the most powerful military in the world.
That's really interesting. It's almost as if you're claiming that the founders were early crypto barons or something, creating a new form of currency.
In a sense, they were. I mean, in a sense, what they were the inheritors of a tradition of people who, beginning in the late 17th century, had decided that they were going to completely reimagine money on their own terms. And like the broader point is, if they hadn't done that, if they hadn't reimagined money for American circumstances, they almost certainly would never have gone to war against Great Britain, and they couldn't have won the war if they had.
Okay, well, we've been using this word money quite a bit, so can we just pin down, as we're using the word money, what are you actually talking about when you talk about money?
Well, money is a really difficult thing to explain, both philosophically, you know, theoretically, and historically.
Well, thanks, Andrew.
I know.
That's why I invited you.
To make it obvious to me that it was going to be complicated. All right. So I'll try to explain this the way that I think about money in, like, I don't know, the most obvious or sort of intuitive ways. So first, I'll sort of give an idea of like what people typically think money is, like in all times and places. So the general account of like what money is that it's a medium of exchange, a unit of account, and a store of value, right? So we have like with the US dollar, the medium of exchange is like a dollar bill, or it might be some sort of like, you know, electronic ones and zeros if it's moving between bank accounts or whatever. The unit of account is the dollar itself. That's the way that we talk about value in the world. And the store of the value is the function that we believe in the US government, that the value of the dollar is going to be the same, or at least sort of roughly similar 10 years from now as it is today. We sort of believe that that value is going to last over time. Well, historians of money over the last 20 years have sort of developed a new way of thinking about this. Rather than taking this sort of broad definition of money and sort of trying to apply it in all times and places, we've developed a way of thinking about money as something that changes over time, as kind of like money as an actor's category, if that makes sense. Which is to say that, like, even though, you know, all sorts of different people around the world use money, quote unquote, and I'm using scare quotes, in fact, they arrange it in all sorts of different ways. And the way that they arrange it institutionally, based on their particular circumstances, their particular histories, where they are, the sort of the ideas that they're drawing from, are actually really, really significant, right? Because it, you know, for instance, raises the possibility of a bunch of colonies, like on the periphery of the Atlantic world, going to war against a superpower. Right, because they had a variety of money that actually fit their circumstances and allowed them to mobilize like wealth for the purpose of, you know, fighting a war in a way that otherwise would have been impossible. Right, so money is not just this sort of medium of exchange, or not just sort of this economic thing. It ends up becoming a really, really, really crucial political category in the 18th century. It's a way that you're organizing your society and expresses sort of the, you know, I guess your vision of what like a just society or a good society in fact looks like. The crucial thing about this, from the perspective of when we're talking about the Declaration, is that Americans had in fact arranged money very, 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 very differently from their British counterparts.
Okay, and we're going to get to that, but I think we have to actually go farther back now. So money, we're going to take it as these three concepts. It's the thing that we're talking about, it's so complicated, I've already forgotten. What are the three things again?
I know that there's almost no way to explain money without making it, in fact, more complicated as opposed to less, and I really apologize for that.
That's okay. No, I think I get it, but it was the three things. It was the...
So it's medium of exchange, store of value, and unit of account. So the medium of exchange is the thing itself. Mm-hmm. Unit of account is the way that we talk about it. So it's the way that we express when we say, like, you know, this, I don't know, jacket is worth $100.
Right.
That expression of value is we're using the unit of account. And the store of value is the way that it actually, in fact, lasts.
And I do want to get to the store of value, because I've always understood money abstractly as this concept of trust or faith.
Yeah, yeah.
In something. And is that third thing you're talking about, the store of value, that you actually have trust, faith, or some notion that you believe in, that there will be a way for you in the future to use this money in some sort of real way?
Yeah, the anthropologist Mary Douglas said that, you know, money is the ritual that we in the modern world use to connect the past, the present, and the future. And the store of the value is the way that we sort of make that ritual work, right? We work today and we work yesterday in order to earn money, which is not only valuable in the present, but like means that we'll be able to do things in the future, right? It's the way that we think about our retirement, the way that we think about, you know, the way we're going to care for our kids and care for our parents, like all that sort of stuff is embedded in the way that we organize money today.
Right. You have to believe in some sort of stability and order in order for any of this to work, too. And I'm just mentioning this because if you're going to have a revolution, you're undermining stability and order. So, like, you know, as you're saying this, so the founding fathers are already a year and 3 months into war after Lexington and Concord, and now... Mm-hmm. They are declaring independence, and they know they're going to get executed if they're caught having signed this. And yet they need to pay for it, but they don't have gold and silver. And so they need some, you know, they need to present this idea that, oh, yes, the forms of money we're creating will be valuable, but we're fighting a war right now, and we have no idea what the future will be. So you're really just going to have to trust us that this is going to work.
Yeah, it was an.
This is where we are risking our fortunes on this gamble.
Yeah, it was an absolutely wild leap of faith. It was a leap of faith, and that's actually why it was so important that they developed this form of money, this alternative form of money previously, because there's no way they could have come up with it in the moment. There's okay. No way that they would have been able to trust it, right?
Super long preamble just to set the scene. But let's now get into the details of those previous forms of money. I'm just getting to the end, but we need to get into this the actual history here now. So the bill of credit. What the heck is a bill of credit?
So the bill of credit was an alternative monetary form which was invented in the Americas beginning in 1690 in order to more or less create a way for the colonies to finance their military expeditions without resorting to using gold and silver.
So like in the French and Indian War, perhaps this would be used...
Yeah. It was so. Initially, what had happened was, so in 1690, Massachusetts invaded Canada looking for gold, which seems sort of like a strange situation. But as usual in 1690, you know, Britain was at war with France, and therefore the, you know, Britain's colonists in North America were also at war with France, and the English colonists in Massachusetts, in particular, were under a huge amount of pressure to invade Canada in order to cut off invaders who are coming down the Hudson Valley from the north. So this is a dynamic that's going to repeat itself over and over and over again in the French and Indian War, also called the Seven Years' War, but all through the 18th century. The thing is that they don't really have any resources to do it. When people are taxing in early, like, colonial America, often they're being, when the taxes are actually being paid in kind. So they're being paid in grain, they're being paid in timber, they're being paid in all these different ways. So the idea is they're going to mount this massive expedition. They're going to send 2,500 men, 32 ships. They're going to invade French Quebec. And then they're going to plunder the place, right? So they're going to rob all of the Catholic churches. They sort of have this sort of imaginary that, like, if you go to a Catholic church as opposed to a Puritan church, it's just going to be covered in gilt and gold and silver, right? And they're just going to take all that stuff. They're going to melt down the crosses. And they're going to pay for the expedition. Okay. But then what happens is, unfortunately, they said, unfortunately, depending on your perspective, I guess, they set out too late. So they get right to Quebec City. So, you know, that massive Cape Diamant on the St. Lawrence River, just as the snow and like the freezing rain is beginning to fall. So the weather has turned against them. They try to invade. They go out in the swamps. They're getting killed, and they're getting killed not just because of they're fighting, but disease takes hold. They're freezing to death. They're starving, and in the end, they have to throw the whole thing away, get back on their ships, and go back to Boston with having plundered absolutely nothing. Right. So when they get back, roughly half the expedition was sick or had died, in fact. So over 1,000 men had died over the course of this. But the men who'd survived had been promised payment. So all of these, sort of sickly veterans, disease-ridden veterans who are really, really, really devastated as winter is coming on, are in Boston. And what happens is the Massachusetts General Court has absolutely no way to pay them because they'd expected this huge mass of plunder. So there's this crisis moment. There's this crisis moment in November of 1690 where, I guess luckily, or you could say sort of fortuitously, there happened to be, in that region, there happened to be a new set of ideas about how money might be organized that the General Court just decided to try. And that form of money is the ancestor of what became bills of credit, the form of money that financed the American Revolution.
And what exactly did they do? What? How did they construct whatever this thing was?
So they don't have any gold and silver, right? Okay, they don't have any gold and silver. Well, they thought, okay, and this is based on the ideas of a particular individual whose story I think we're going to get into, John Blackwell, who is a revolutionary figure in England, decades before. They thought, okay, money is not gold. They don't have any gold and silver. But what if the idea that money has to be gold and silver, that in fact has to be an object, a medium of exchange, is in fact a conceptual mistake, right? This is Blackwell's idea. He thinks, in fact, the key idea about money is that in fact it is a unit of account, like it's a way of measuring value. He calls this money as a measure. Right, and that it's actually that way of measuring value is only instituted as an object in particular times and places for like a variety of different political reasons. In other words, money doesn't have to be gold and silver. In fact, it could be instituted as a kind of relationship between citizens and their states, or the colony in this case, right? You following me, this?
I am totally following you.
All right.
No, I mean, I'm just, so you said they're states. So what you're saying is between a citizen and the government, however conceived. You said state or colony, but more generally, governments.
Exactly, in governments in general. All right. So this is the way the thinking goes for a bill of credit. Sort of having made that conceptual leap that money doesn't have to be gold and silver, right? So that's the first move you have to make. The second move you have to make is, how do we establish that relationship, okay? So they think through what sort of monetary powers they have in the absence of gold and silver. Now, the power they have, the single most important power that any colony like Massachusetts has, is the power to impose taxes on its citizenry, all right? So what they think through, and this is another sort of conceptual advancement, is the idea that when you actually are imposing a tax, what you're doing is you're imposing a debt, okay? So what they think is, okay, and this is kind of clever, in 18th century conceptions, or actually sort of like, if you think about financial accounting today, every debt is balanced by a credit, right? So there's no reason, they think, that this credit actually has to be gold and silver. It has to be like any particular object. If they can impose a debt, they can at the same time impose a credit. So what they decide they're going to do is they're going to print up a whole bunch of credits against a tax debt that they plan to impose. So those credits are going to be called bills of credit. They will be printed up. They will be treated as if they're money. They will be used to pay off all the soldiers in the expedition, all the suppliers, all of the merchants. And then those people will then sell them on to everyone else who has to pay taxes. Okay? Then the taxes will be gathered up, will be returned to the central Massachusetts government, and because the debt has been satisfied, they'll in fact burn that money. So it's a temporary money which allows the credit of the state in that relationship between the citizens and their government to circulate for a time, pay the debt, sort of satisfy the needs of all the people who are involved in this expedition, and then it'll disappear, right?
Yeah, I get it.
Yeah.
Okay, can I just ask a question about ancient Rome now?
Sure.
Well, no, you were saying that this is a way of sort of avoiding tax, and I'm thinking of the Roman practice. Ship's captains, if they did a boat run to Egypt to pick up grain to bring back to Rome, they would not have to pay port taxes or any taxes for the rest of the year. So wow. They weren't paid, right? They were exempted from having to pay. And that I can see. Now I'm understanding. Well, that's a form of payment too then, right? Not having to pay a tax and so allowing to access all the ports without having to pay basically means, this is a form of credit. You are earning by not having to pay dues.
Yeah.
Is that exactly the same concept?
It's a tax credit. So a bill of credit is a tax credit that circulates as money, mm-hmm. based on the idea that everyone eventually is going to have to pay taxes, or everyone who has anything.
Do you think they got this idea from ancient Rome? I guess it's, you say Blackwell did it, Cromwell's treasurer, but like, as you go back through history, is this something that we see more often?
I mean, I don't think they got the idea from ancient Rome so much as they got the idea of the way that they organized, credit and debt in their everyday lives.
Okay.
What you're describing in terms of paying with a credit, it's just more or less the way that 18th century households tended to do business, right?
Okay.
It's a very, very old way of doing business, a way of doing business which Europeans developed in order to avoid gold and silver in moments when there wasn't the means to pay.
Okay.
Yeah, we could go into that. I mean, it's really...
No, I don't want to go into Rome anymore. That's what I was thinking as you were describing this, because I always thought it was fascinating how Rome's logistics system worked, getting all that grain to Rome, and they did it by incentivizing people to do the work for them, and it was exempting them from taxes. But that's all. Anyway, let's go back to now John Blackwell here. You mentioned Cromwell's treasurer. Why do we need this part of the story to tell the history of money in the Declaration now?
Well, in a sense, it's like the way that, America's money, the money that allowed, the American Revolution to take place, in a sense, was part of this older British revolutionary legacy. That it took this, this particular figure who'd come out of, the revolution that had beheaded Charles I, we've been intimately involved in the creation of a republic in Britain, during the English Civil Wars. It took that sort of the legacy of that kind of revolutionary violence going back, even before, the American colonies had need of it he was able to bring sort of the authority and the ideas about finance to Massachusetts in that moment that allowed them, I don't know what the world is, kind of the confidence it would have taken to, decide that they were going to, in effect, upend, the way that they had thought of money, this sort of basic institution for organizing daily life, in a moment of crisis. A moment of crisis, which is analogous to what was happening in 1776.
Okay. So Blackwell, John Blackwell, he's Cromwell's treasurer, and he's instituting this new concept of money. So what is his idea of money? And just explain it again in case we haven't quite grasped this new revolutionary attitude towards money.
So his basic idea, as I said, is that money doesn't have to be gold and silver. It could be instituted as gold and silver, but it doesn't need to be instituted as gold and silver. And as we were talking about the origins of that idea, there's sort of a couple of backstories to the origins of that idea. I guess we could talk through three.
Okay.
The first is that he was the treasurer of war, so he was the person in charge of paying the British armies and the invasion of Ireland, which is an absolutely devastating event in the late 1640s, early 1650s. And what he discovered when he was in Ireland was that the Irish, in fact, had an economy that was very, 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 very lightly monetized, right? So when Irish peasants or landholders paid rent to landowners, they didn't pay rent in gold and silver. They, in fact, paid rent in kind, in whatever they were able to produce. So in cattle, in grain, all these variety of different things. And that became a real problem when it came to distributing the loot involved in the conquest of Ireland, right? How are we going to value these lands if we don't, in fact, know what the monetary return on those lands is? And this led to the development of a set of ideas, particularly by an intellectual who was, in fact, hired by Blackwell, Sir William Petty, who's an anatomist at Oxford who'd been hired by Cromwell to go to Ireland to sort of study this problem, to figure out how they could like create links between an Irish colonial economy and the economy in Britain itself, led to this idea that like money, in fact, could be something other than the coins, you know, that had been traditionally used in Britain, and could be, in fact, like a way of sort of like organizing value that transcended like its monetary roots. So that's number one. Number two is Blackwell and all of these sort of revolutionaries in the 16th century were all just sort of wild about figuring out new ways of organizing financial systems. So the 17th century was a period where people were trying to come up with new ways to more or less like increase the amount of coin, no matter where they were. There were all kinds of like crazy solutions. So this is a period where people are coming up with, you know, ideas that we're going to build banks which are based on land. We're going to build banks which are based on all sorts of different things. But the idea is like we're going to build a new kind of institution on some sort of like new conceptual foundation, which will allow us to more or less like find the philosopher's stone to create money out of nothing. And Blackwell's very involved in these issues over the course of the 17th century. So he's involved in trying to set up a new bank in London. The first thing that he does more or less after he arrives in Massachusetts for the first time in 1684 is trying to set up what he calls a new bank of credit based on his own sort of like, you know, heterodox ideas about money. So he's in this milieu where everyone is more or less trying to think through like how they're going to organize, not everyone, but like a significant portion of like people who are in this financial elite are trying to think through like new ways about how they're going to organize and multiply money, right? So he was in a world where his ideas were like sort of one kind of strange idea among many. The third is that, you know, when he ended up being exiled after the Restoration in 1660 and living in Ireland, right? So he ends up living in this place that does not, in fact, have much gold and silver. And the fact is, in the early modern world, lots of places, including in, you know, throughout the British Isles, did not have much gold and silver. And the way that they did business, in fact, was on household credit. So that is to say, if someone, like say that, you know, I was a, this goes back to Adam Smith, so it's maybe like a deeper discussion, but like if I was a fisherman or something like that, or, you know, if I was a cobbler, say I made shoes, right? Let's just say that. If you make shoes and you're sort of like the shoemaker in your small town in Ireland or in Connecticut at the exact same time, and in a world where there's no money, like what are you making shoes for, in a sense, right? You're not making shoes because you can get paid cash on the barrelhead. What you end up doing is you make shoes for families, and what they give you in return is, in effect, a credit, right? Which means that they, in the future, will provide you with some sort of good or service. So if you actually go into early modern archives, you'll find a lot of what are called account books. And these account books will have entries where on one side, this is also, you know, called double entry bookkeeping, on one side will be debts, on the other side will be credits. And these two things always balance each other out. But what this allows people to do is to create, you know, financial wealth in a world where there is no gold or silver present, or very, very little that's circulating. So he's already sort of living in a world where people have this sort of like older vernacular solution to the problem of the absence of gold and silver. And sort of his genius, or I guess the significance of like his particular contribution, is that he puts all these things together. He puts together the insight that money doesn't have to be gold and silver, with the idea that money can in fact be this relationship established in terms of debits and credits, which are sort of involved in the early modern household. And he decides that, you know, and he also puts it into institutional form, right? Creating a new form of currency, which could actually be used by a bank on the one hand, but also by these colonies in North America.
Got it. Okay. I have several detour questions, and then we'll get back to our story, and we're going to get back to North America as soon as I'm done with this. The first thing I was thinking about as you were talking about this is this new way of thinking about money actually solves the problem of war, namely paying soldiers.
Absolutely.
If you can only pay soldiers in coin and you don't have coin, you've got a problem. So you have to figure out a way of paying soldiers another way, which you might not need to come up with if you weren't waging war.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, it's almost like kind of a money and war and these monetary systems can't be developed without war, which is kind of depressing.
Or maybe that just that they wouldn't have been, you know, at least on the level of, you know, statecraft.
Right. The second thing, as you were talking about Ireland, I was recalling a passage from something that I read. George Washington in letters with someone in Ireland, the Irish landowner could not understand how Washington could earn money because he didn't have any tenants. And of course, because the tenant model, if you were a landowner in Ireland, you made money either through this in-kind payment. And Washington never kind of spilled the beans that the way he earned wealth, money, was because he had 200 or 400 or however many enslaved people doing his work for him, and essentially creating this in-kind wealth that then he could use as credit against other things.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing about this kind of money, which, you know, Blackwell created, and, you know, the Massachusetts actually implemented in 1690, it was just like wildly useful in colonial America. So it spreads like wildfire. Like, almost immediately it's implemented in New York, in North Carolina. You know, within 50 years, by 1757, every single colony in North America has created some version of bills of credit.
Right. And these are used, amongst other things, to pay soldiers.
Yeah, they're used basically for collective projects which are beyond the means of any particular individual, right? So war is the biggest one, but there are other ones. So, you know, building...
Are we now defining war as a collective project, like building a bridge?
Yeah, it is, though. I mean, that's what...
I guess if we're being very neutral...
I mean, it's a nasty collective project, but it's a collective project.
okay, so another serious question. Yeah. So, you know, you can pay soldiers through the bill of credit. Mm-hmm. You can also pay them with land, correct?
You can pay them with land, but that's really, really, really tricky.
So what I'm just trying to understand is how is a land payment different than a bill of credit payment? Why would one be more tricky than the other?
The reason is because, you know, commodifying land, like knowing what is on a particular set of, acreage in the 18th century and the 17th century is a lot harder than it sort of initially appears. Like, you have to send someone out there. They have to know, you know, what soil types are, the agronomy, like what the trees are, sort of the possibilities, you know, whether or not it's well watered, all these different things, which make land sort of like wildly variable in terms of a means of payment, which is not to say that it wasn't used. It's just it wasn't usually enough because it's difficult to promise it, and it's difficult to promise it equally to people, is what I would say.
Yeah, so I'm just recalling one of the reasons that colonists had grievances against King George is after the Seven Years' War, the French and Indian War, you know, they were promised land west of the Appalachians, but then King George was like, proclamation of 1763, where that's going to be Indian territory instead of this good land that we were going to pay you with, right? You can get that mosquito-infested swamp in Georgia and Florida instead.
Right? Yeah, that's true. There's a way, like, yeah, land is always this one of these things, because, you know, the thing about, of course, land in the West is, like, there's other people on it, right? It's Native American land. So when you're promising people this land, you're, in fact, promising the right to conquest, which was really, really tricky for the empire to do at the same moment when they were trying to incorporate, like, these new Native American nations, like, into their version of, like, what, you know, North America was going to be as well.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So let's take it back to the colonies. So it had been entrenched in colonial society, and indeed European society, that there are all sorts of different ways of conceiving of money and doing these collective projects like war, or in this case, rebellion and revolution, and you don't need gold and silver. So do you just want to summarize that once again?
Yeah. So the idea that, you know, that money can be instituted in a variety of ways, and it could be this relationship between people and their government, was extremely liberating in a variety of ways. Like, for one thing, you can't run out of it, right? No, you never run out of these debt and credit relationships. There's something that can be reproduced sort of endlessly, right? So the problem of scarcity of money, like the ability to pay soldiers in particular, but also just like fund a war more broadly, or build a bridge, or build a house, or build a lighthouse, all these different things that the colonies want to do. Like, suddenly scarcity becomes not the limiting factor, like scarcity of wealth. The second piece of it is that it actually, like, really sort of, like, nicely accords with the way that the early American colonists like to think of their wealth. So if you think about George Washington, the example you're using, right? He wasn't wealthy in terms of money at all. Like, if you go into his account books, like, he has like a few pounds in silver. Like, occasionally he has bills of credit, right? So, like, his monetary wealth is just extraordinarily tiny. But his physical wealth, his wealth in terms of land, in terms of enslaved people, and also in terms of the credit relationships he's developed with his neighbors and also with his correspondents overseas, is absolutely massive, right? So what a bill of credit does is it allows for, you know, a colony to mobilize the kind of wealth that George Washington had by pledging his fortune, like, quite literally. That's what they did every time they went to war. Like, every single one of these colonies would pledge the fortunes of their wealthiest colonists in order to create these bills of credit. But because once the credit was a credit against a tax debt, and because the tax debt would be satisfied once those taxes were paid, they could also eliminate that form of money as an alternative and sort of like competing form of wealth as opposed to land and as opposed to enslaved people, right? So at the end of the day, once they burned their money, which is what they did every year, which is kind of the weirdest thing about bills of credit.
Yeah, they burned the money to balance the books.
Yeah, exactly. So once they did that, right, the property regime was more or less the status quo antebellum. So money would circulate, it would create this sort of dynamic economy for a time, and then it would just go away.
And they would literally burn it. You're not saying
they would literally physically burn it.
Was there like some sort of ritual attached?
Yeah. So you gotta think about it. So once again, this is like I said, this could never be explained often enough because it's such a strange thing. A bill of credit is a credit against a tax debt, right? So it's basically a tax credit. So there are taxes, like, in the world that balance those out that these people are going to have to pay. So, like, if we do, like, a concrete example, like, say the colony sets a tax for 10,000 pounds that it's going to pay over, like, the next 5 years or so. Subsequent to passing that tax, they would create bills of credit, which people could then use to pay that tax, right? And then they would pay those bills of credit out to their soldiers, out to whoever was involved in the project that they were involved in, right? Over the next 5 years, those bills of credit would come back into the treasury. And the colonies, the idea is that when they came back, they in fact settled the tax, which allowed them to exist in the first place. So colonies had these laws, and it's very, very explicit. So what they would do is they would count them up, they would punch holes in them to make sure that they couldn't be reused once the taxes had been paid, and then they would bundle them together, and usually like in the presence of the governor or like a counselors or members of the legislature, they would burn it. And they would do this every year. They would burn their tax receipts. Taxes had been paid.
But it totally makes sense. This is how you pay for infrastructure, like building new roads and building new bridges and building a port and maybe even building an army or a navy.
Right? Absolutely.
Great. As we were talking about, again, just a stupid aside, I read somewhere that Thomas Jefferson went bankrupt because he was importing too much port wine from France. And I was just curious. I wonder because like Washington, he just didn't have the gold and silver. He had all this physical wealth, as we said, but he just didn't have the gold and silver, which you needed to pay your French winemakers.
That's exactly right. Like all, basically early America, and this is true of more or less everywhere outside of like, you know, very, very few places, like in metropolitan Europe, are land rich and cash poor. Like that's just the basic status quo in early modern Europe. And it's definitely status quo in colonial America. What actually happened with Thomas Jefferson is a bit more devastating than specific, actually. So I wish I could go into if you're interested in it.
I am actually interested.
Yeah, it's a really, really, really crazy story, which has to do with, you know, more or less like the state of Virginia over the course of the war, like, you know, they come up with an idea. So American governments, in order to finance themselves, are always making these conceptual leaps. And so they decide that, like, you know, in a war, right, it's legal to confiscate your enemy's goods, right? So it's called contraband. It's actually similar to the kind of dynamic which is going to lead to, like, the first emancipations over the course of the Civil War. And they think that, like, at the end of the day, like, the enemy's goods, which are most significant to Virginia planters, are the debts and credits that these people have in Great Britain. So what they decide they're going to do is they're going to confiscate all the debts which are owned.
Wait, pause, please. I'm sorry, pause. So all of these debts and credits are not just localized within colonial economies. They're going back to Britain.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, fascinating.
Yeah, well, because you have to do business on the other side of the Atlantic in terms of credit and debt as well, right? So
I assumed wrongly, clearly. That if you were trading back to old Europe, they would only accept cash.
Bizarrely, no.
Gold and silver. Okay.
They really actually have no interest in, they have interest in cash in a particular set of circumstances. But in general, what they're interested in receiving is things where you get a profit by translating, you know, by transferring it across the Atlantic. So, you know, if we're talking about early America, they're more or less like interested in tobacco and rice and indigo, all these things that you can grow in the colonial South and can't grow in Europe, because that's more valuable in Europe than it would be in America. Like actually transferring gold and silver around the Atlantic is actually really expensive. You have to pay to protect it. You have to insure it. And it's actually not more valuable in Europe than it is in America. So you don't earn a return on it, if you know what I mean.
So as much as these economies are intertwined, the monetary systems are intertwined, they are separate as well. So how do we start seeing this divergence in monetary policy, I guess I'm calling it? Is that the correct word? Between the colonial economies and colonial money and British imperial economy and British imperial money.
So this is what's absolutely fascinating. It's actually this divergence. It's the creation of bills of credit in 1690 by John Blackwell, which kicks off the whole American revolutionary process to begin with.
So you're saying 85 years earlier, the roots of the revolution were in this new form of bill of credit.
Yeah, actually.
Okay.
I mean, awesome. It sounds surprising, but it's like...
It's really surprising.
But I'll explain to you why. It's because at the end of the day, and as everyone knows, like, yeah, the American Revolution was kicked off, as every school child knows, and as we print on the license plates in our capital, Washington, D.C., right? The revolution happened because of the fight against taxation without representation. And it turns out that the fight about taxation in particular is in fact a fight about money. Okay, so in order to explain that fight, we have to go back actually to the question you were just asking about how these two economies had diverged in terms of the way that they had created monetary institutions. So in 1690, Blackwell and these people in Massachusetts, the General Court of Massachusetts, designed this new kind of money, bills of credit, which allows them to circulate currency to fight wars more or less without using gold and silver.
And this was to pay for the failed invasion of Canada.
Paid for the failed invasion of Canada, but then goes on to pay for every colonial war over the course of the 18th century. So in sums of tens of millions of pounds. So that it becomes this massive institution. It's the central institution of America in like fiscal warfare over the course of the entire 18th century, including, of course, the American Revolution itself. Okay, but simultaneously, on the other side of the Atlantic in Great Britain in 1694, right, this exact same sort of like conceptual revolution and how money is going to be ordered results in a very different institution, which is in fact the Bank of England. So the Bank of England is trying to solve, in a sense, the same problem. They're trying to solve the problem of how do we create more money so we can fight these wars against Catholic Europe. But it comes to a very, very, very different solution. Their solution is, instead of like avoiding the problem of gold and silver, what they're going to do is they're going to create a private institution which can print banknotes which represent gold and silver. The idea being that there can in fact be way more banknotes in circulation than there in fact is silver in the vaults of the bank. So they can expand the money supply without in fact challenging the idea that money is necessarily gold and silver. So in a sense, where America had decided to avoid the problem of gold and silver, this new institutional fix called bills of credit, Great Britain had decided to double down on the idea that money is necessarily gold and silver through this new private banking institution.
And the banknote.
And the banknote, precisely. Precisely. So over the course of the 18th century, both of these things are developing simultaneously with only sort of vague awareness of each other. So when we arrive at the end of the Seven Years' War, Americans over the course of that war had spent millions of pounds in bills of credit, right? So by the end of the war, the British government thinks that they've spent 2.5 million pounds that they've gone into debt. They've also collected and burned, so this taxation piece of it, 1.7 million pounds, right? So they're actually like very powerful. They're doing their business. So a huge amount of bills of credit have been spent. Simultaneously, Britain has borrowed tens of millions of pounds in terms of gold and silver. They have heavily invested in a financial apparatus which depends at the end of the day in anchoring their money to the value of precious metal. And it turns out that when Britain decides it wants to tax America for a variety of reasons that we could get into, they decide that the only way that they can be sure that the value of the taxes that they impose are going to be, you know, what they think it is to in fact tax Americans in the very silver they had created an entire monetary economy to avoid.
So they're putting the Bank of England gold silver based banknote system, they're trying to overlay that on the colonies who had developed a wholly or pretty much independent system of doing all their finance.
Absolutely, but it's even worse, right? Because there's no Bank of England in America. There's no banknotes. There's no way to like multiply the currency, right? So what they do is, so this is what's called the Stamp Act Crisis of 1765. At the end of the Seven Years' War, Britain's massively in debt. It decides it needs to get some sort of I don't know, sort of buy-in from the American colonies, because it, in fact, at that moment, costs more to tax American colonies than they're actually receiving in tax receipts. So they come up with a variety of ways to do that, but the most significant one ends up being what's called the Stamp Act of 1765, which is a tax on, like, virtually everything printed in the American colonies, so books, pamphlets, newspapers, but also, crucially, a tax on virtually every legal instrument which the American colonies used to participate in the British Empire itself. So we're talking about land deeds, we're talking about pleas in courts, we're talking about different kinds of licenses, all of these, basically everything that you would use to interact with the British legal state, like on a civil basis, they put a tax on.
Did they also tax the bill of credit itself, the actual piece of paper?
No, they don't. They don't tax bills of credit themselves. They intervened in bills of credit actually a little bit earlier in a completely different way, which is called the Currency Act of 1764.
Okay.
So the Currency Act of 1764 limits colonies' ability to print bills of credit outside of wartime, right?
Oh, so they're actually tying it as I had tied it early. They're specific. The British Empire is now specifically tying bills of credit to the problem of war and saying you can only do this in wartime.
Yeah, or you can only do it to a very limited extent outside of wartime. That's absolutely right. Because the British government's not silly. They know that there isn't like a ton of gold and silver to pay for wars in America. But they're trying to like limit the fiscal flexibility of the American colonies for a variety of other reasons, mostly because as they're reconceiving of the empire after the 7 years of war, the role that America is going to play in this new reconceived empire is as a big consumer of British goods and as goods that they're going to be producing in the East Indies. So, you know, tea, silk, all these different things that they're getting out of South Asia and China in that exact moment. And their idea is that America, which has a population which doubles every 25 years, is going to be this massive growth market, which is going to make up for the fact that they can't, in fact, sell these things very well in Europe for a variety of reasons. Okay? Mm-hmm. So they're interested in sort of limiting, squashing Americans' access to their own monetary forms because they want Americans to be a good consumer. But that's not actually the reason that they decide to tax the Americans in this particular currency at this particular time. Like, so in the Stamp Act, the reason that they decide to tax Americans in silver bullion is because they're unwilling to tax them in their own monetary form, in a sense. Because they think if they're going to create more bills of credit, like that's just going to add to the problem. So what we're going to do is they're going to tax Americans in silver bullion valued at 5 shillings, 6 pence in the ounce on the hope that Americans are going to be able to come up with that silver, even though, like I said, they created an entire monetary system in order to avoid it. This creates, in fact, like the beginning of the revolutionary crisis.
Did they actually realize that maybe the colonists didn't have it? They didn't have the silver and gold reserves? Like,
this is the thing that's kind of like funny about the story, is that they were told that over and over, right? So there's people in the British government who know that Americans don't have gold and silver. But the thing is like the idea that money and wealth is gold and silver, or like can be equated to gold and silver, is so deeply embedded in the British mind by the 1760s, particularly elite minds, that they can't imagine that American colonies could be wealthy without, in fact, having gold and silver. And so there's these debates, right, where Benjamin Franklin, all these different people go to George Grenville, go to his representatives in the ministry, and they try to explain to them how they're rich in one sense. They're rich in the sense that George Washington is rich, in the terms that Thomas Jefferson was rich, right? They're rich in land. They're rich in, you know, they have these beautiful houses. They're rich in enslaved people. They're rich in all these different ways, but they're not rich in money. And Grenville decides that he just doesn't quite believe them. He doesn't quite believe they don't have the silver that he wants from them. So he just decides to risk it. And that risk, you know, ends up igniting the American Revolution.
Fascinating. And so we see this now in the Declaration of Independence. We mutually pledge to each other our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor, I mean, that our fortunes phrase is not a throwaway phrase at all. And it's amazing that I've read this now thousands of times, and it just seems like lives, fortunes, sacred honor sounds rhetorically interesting, but not significant. It's hugely significant. So thank you. Thank you so much for clarifying those two words, our fortunes. So here we are at the Declaration of Independence. It's released. And now the Continental Congress has to do something to generate money for the war. And we have the birth of the Continental Dollar.
Yes.
So why don't you just tell us about the next chapter here?
So Americans went into the war and they decided to, you know, basically double down on the notion of bills of credit, right? By doubling down, I mean that they decided to take it to a continental scale. And this was an incredible thing. Instead of having individual colonies basing a credit on their ability to tax, like something that was actually very, very like visceral and material in the lives of individual colonists who had to pay these taxes, they decided they were going to believe in the future power of like a continental association to levy those taxes. And they do it really, really quickly. So just, you know, a couple of months after the fighting starts in June 1775, they print the first bills of credit. And within a year, it's millions of bills of credit, of dollars worth of bills of credit that are being paid throughout the colony to fund the war effort. It's absolutely massive. But then they run into this problem. And this is exactly the problem that you were pointing out earlier, this problem of belief, this problem of, in fact, government control, which it is very, very, very difficult over the course of a really, really long war, over an 8-year war, to maintain the belief that these taxes are, in fact, going to be paid. And in particular, it's hard to maintain it in the face of an invading British army. So initially in 1775, you more or less, you have the siege of Boston, which the colonies end up winning. The money is bolstered by that. It's trading at par with gold and silver, even though it's just this tax credit. But in 1776, of course, right after the declaration happens, the British Army invades New York and Long Island and takes a massive population center, and also New Jersey, off the board, which means to say, like, people in New Jersey and in New York and Long Island are no longer going to be paying taxes, which is to say that debt that they owed has been extinguished. And with it, sort of the credibility of the Continental Dollar there, but also everywhere, because the Continental Dollar is actually like rooted in the possibility that this war is going to be won.
Quick aside before you carry on. Would the British like to be nasty, burn bills of credit?
What they did is they thought the idea that paper money was the way that the colonies were paying for the war was really, really funny. So whenever they conquered a particular, like an American city, they would immediately start running the presses, which had been used to print local bills of credit or even continental dollars when they captured Philadelphia in 1777, in order to run off counterfeits. And they would give these counterfeits at price to anyone who showed up as a way of disrespecting the monetary form of their enemies.
Wow.
They did everything they could. So, you know, ideologically, there were songs that were written, you know, making fun of the American currency. And also, you know, materially, they, at one point, for instance, there's a whole bunch of British prisoners of war who are, you know, in out in western Pennsylvania and out near to Virginia. And they actually sneak a huge amount of counterfeit continental dollars into a wagon, which is supposed to be full of food going out to feed these prisoners of war. The idea that they can, like, more or less, like, Trojan horse bunch of like continental counterfeits like into the center of the rebellion as a way of undermining people's faith in the currency. So, you know, more or less, like, Americans run into like the basic problem that you can't like organize money as a credit against a tax debt in a world where the British Army is invading and taking whole regions and their ability to tax off the board. This becomes even more devastating in 1778, 1779, 1780, 81, when the British Army is roaming through the colonial South. At that point, the Continental Dollar, the idea that, like, you know, this is just going to hold together and they're going to be able to, like, charge these taxes and bring it in and burning, like, more or less, the people lose all faith in it. And the people who lose the most faith in it are, in fact, the people in the army themselves, because they're seeing
Not only are farmers charging massive prices, but they also won't accept continental dollars at any price in a lot of instances, which means that the army, like in a world where in fact there's still like material abundance, where there's still like, you know, there's still food, people are still doing, you know, relatively well, living on their own, are starving. And this creates like a devastating problem. It means like more that the colonists who'd had faith in their in this sort of like crazy set of ideas, what they knew were a very, very different set of ideas at the beginning of war, in fact would have to rethink all of their monetary institutions on the fly. In the war itself, they would have to reimagine what money was. And that was in fact like the most devastating moment for so many different individuals involved in the war. Like that was the moment where they all lost faith. In the sense that they didn't lose faith in the cause, right? They didn't lose faith in the ideals of the Declaration of Independence, and so say, but they lost faith in that, in the sense that like that their ideas, like these ideas that had carried them to war, in fact, could see them through it. So what they decide to do, and it's a bunch of merchants in Philadelphia who do this first, is that they're going to found a bank along the lines of the Bank of England to finance the war. Hilariously, they have absolutely no idea how the Bank of England works. So it takes them about a year to figure it out. And even then, they're not really quite sure. They never really get the idea that the bank is about multiplying currency. They never get the idea that the Bank of North America is what it's called. We never sort of like had silver in its vaults and then spent, you know, vastly over the amount that it had. So they didn't, you know, solve the problem of the scarcity of money. What they tried to use the bank to do, in fact, was to create a new discipline around money, right? To, in fact, transform what money was in the minds of the farmers who they needed to get on board and in order to pay for the war. And they were really, really, really successful in doing so. So in the middle of the war, like the revolutionary currency, which had allowed the war to operate in the first place, gets abandoned and gets replaced. You know, which is an absolutely amazing transformation.
Wow. So am I understanding you right that this bill of credit system is not wholly sort of undermined by the new Bank of North America? It's just operating in parallel so they can mutually reinforce each other and create some stability. And then it's just basically just to restore faith, which all of these new fancy financial instruments require in order to allow trade to happen in the first place.
Yeah, and like remarkably, the kind of an amazing thing is that after the war ends, all of the states now, right, under the Articles of Confederation, start printing bills of credit. Once again, they want to pay off their soldiers, right? They want to pay off their suppliers. They want to pay off the debts they've incurred in the war. But not all of them, yeah.
Well, and then they also want to, once that's paid off, they want to continue building those infrastructure projects that you can only do if your debts are cleared, and then you can do new things to build up the new United States.
But the problem is that there was a consensus before the war that this was the only way you could do things. And what the bank had created, and also the devastation around, you know, the way that the continental dollar disintegrated in 1789 and 1780, had created in the minds of revolutionary leadership this idea that, yeah, sure, you could continue to use bills of credit, but at the end of the day, you could never use them to fight another foreign war, right? And this sort of, you know, this lack of consensus meant that different states were implementing bills of credit in different ways, right? Which were creating all these different problems where, you know, a creditor is going from a state where there are very few bills of credit to a state where there are tons. Rhode Island is the most famous example. And suddenly it feels as if, you know, they're being preyed upon by these people who just have like endless cash and can use it to pay off debts in their courts. And this creates all sorts of conflicts between the states in the Articles of Confederation. So finally, when Congress assembles in the Constitutional Convention in 1787, one of the first things on their agenda is to make sure that money, as it's going to be created in the new United States, it's going to be created along lines that the states no longer have any power over. One of the things they do in Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution is explicitly to ban state issue bills of credit.
And that is the origin why all of our money now comes via the federal government and not the state. Is that correct? Oh, no.
It's complicated because what the states immediately do is, of course, they just found their own banks. So there's state banks everywhere. There's wildcat banks. There's all this proliferation of financial
instruments. But today, nowadays, the dollar is a federal instrument of money.
Absolutely. Basically, what the Constitution does is it sets the new set of rules for how we can manipulate money. And those rules are basically very analogous, anyway, to the rules that had been adopted by Britain, roughly a century before when they founded the Bank of England.
Interesting. So actually, although the Americans won the Revolutionary War, we lost the Revolutionary Financial War, in that we abdicated our homegrown continental system for the Bank of England system?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as I say in my book, Britain won the American Revolution in terms of money and finance. Like it created this sister state where its money was as good in America as it was in Britain, and Britain's pour money into America after the War of 1812. They become the number one investor all the way through the 19th century. Because, the war, ironically, which was, the result of this schism within the British Empire, reunited it in terms of money and in terms of finance.
So the war of the banks, as it were, the Bank of England won the financial war, in that the United States followed then a system that was created in Britain, the Bank of England. However, the United States still won the Kinetic War, the War for Independence. Okay, so we're reaching an end now. Andrew, 250 years after the Declaration of Independence, what are your big takeaways?
Oh, man. So, for me, the fact that the American, the founders in the Declaration of Independence, pledged their fortunes, right? And they pledged their fortunes. The fascinating thing about it, as we've been discussing, is that they pledged their fortunes based on a really strange, heterodox, niche, peripheral, unique way of organizing money, and that they were willing to put everything on the line, right? Go to war against the most powerful nation on earth, with the only thing backing them is their own sort of crazy ideas. I think that even though they abandoned those ideas over the course of the revolution, the thing that I draw inspiration from, the thing that kind of is mind-boggling to me about that revolutionary moment, is that they had the faith in those ideas to begin with. And even though they got rid of that particular form of money, I think the fact that the founders had faith in their own ideas and how to organize government, how to create a democracy, how to create a new world, however imperfect, where the ideal would be that all men are created equal, was rooted in that fundamental faith that they could figure things out and that they could do things better, both for themselves, but also, for future generations who are going to inherit that revolution.
Dr. Andrew Edwards, thank you so much. I learned a lot today.
Thank you, Andy.
Life, liberty, the pursuit of
If you enjoyed this podcast and would like to support German-American friendship, why don't you visit us at our website, americatzentrum.de, where you can become a member and donate. The Americatzentrum is a nonpartisan and not-for-profit institution dedicated to strengthening the transatlantic relationship. The views and opinions expressed in the episode are those of the guests or the host, not the Americatzentrum. We take our nonpartisan mission seriously. Therefore, we do not take any institutional positions on politics or policy. Learn more about us, become a member, and donate at americatzentrum.de. Thanks for listening.